Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's the Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. I was at a Minnesota organics conference recently, and I heard an idea worth passing on. A woman told about her company trying to cut healthcare costs by getting employees to eat more fruits and vegetables, and doing it by encouraging them to join a CSA. That's community-supported agriculture. You know, where you buy a share of a local farm and every week get the produce of the moment? Well, instead of the anticipated four or five shares, employees were so enthusiastic the company got 10 shares. Well, wouldn't it be interesting if a company matched the shares? I wonder where that would take us. Well, stay with us for much more and your calls this hour on the Splendid Table. This podcast is brought to you by EasyCanvasPrints.com, turning your photos into works of art. Get your favorite photos on gallery canvas. Visit EasyCanvasPrints.com/SplendidTable to receive 50% off your canvas print.
This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast.
This is the Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, in our dedication to bring you all the possible ways to enjoy comestibles, we have asked the profound question, could there still be a drink that we, the food media, haven't critiqued, dissected, and generally enthused over? Well, yes, there is, and it's schnapps. Travel writer Matt Gross has picked up on what you could call this missing link in a story that he did for Savour magazine. Matt, it's good to have you back.
It's lovely to be here.
You know, I don't want to offend anybody, but you know, I usually think of schnapps as kind of rot gut.
Yeah, in this country, it's pretty bad stuff.
Now, schnapps is a fruit brandy, technically, right?
Yeah. You mash it, you ferment it, and then you distill it. That's the good version, the Austrian version, which is the polar opposite of what we usually get in this country.
And that's where you went to find the great schnapps, from what I understand.
Yeah, I spent about a week last summer traveling around to Austria visiting the great, great schnapps makers of that country. And it's complete revelation, the kind of things that they make. Incredible quality, and just it shows you things about fruit that you never would have expected.
So this is really essentially solely fermented fruit?
Fermented and distilled. I mean, it's pretty high in alcohol, generally 40 to 50% alcohol. So you don't get that just by fermenting. You get you got to distill it once or twice.
Right. Okay. So what separates the not-so-good schnapps from the really fine schnapps?
Well, the stuff that's generally made in this country, the bad schnapps that you probably had at your high school prom, it has all kinds of fillers and sugars and additives and is not made with any particular care. The stuff that you get at the best places in Austria is made with the absolute ripest fruits you can imagine. I mean, the one of the great schnapps makers, Hans Reisetbauer, has acres and acres and acres of fruit trees. So he is waiting until his pears and apples and plums get absolute to the peak of ripeness and then plucking them, fermenting them, and taking the best fruit that you could possibly eat and turning it into the best schnapps you could possibly drink.
So what can it really taste like then?
First, before you even taste it, you have to get to the smell, because the smell of a great schnapps is a thing of beauty. Pear is, I think, my favorite. To smell a pear schnapps is to smell the leaves, the skin, the oils on the skin of a pear, to smell something that is sort of the platonic ideal of pear-ness. It is so much a pear that no actual pear could seem to measure up to it. And yet, there it is in your glass. You're smelling this flavor.
I must say, you make it sound really...
It is really, 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 really nice. Even after you had sips of, 15 or 20 of them, it's still pretty delicious. Yeah. When you have this glass of pear schnapps in front of you, or apricot schnapps, or raspberry schnapps, you're smelling and tasting something that's essential to the fruit that you might not have gotten otherwise.
So this is where the distilling is really art. And I'm just thinking about, if you're saying that essentially what a brandy, a fruit brandy or any brandy is the steam from boiling the fermented fruit, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the alcohol, and that carries all that flavor. There must be a lot of finesse that's needed to get that just right.
Yeah, well, it's an art and it's also a science. I mean, these are computer-controlled, high-tech, advanced, modern 21st century stills. Almost no one who's making the really high-end stuff is just sort of checking the charcoals under the still.
Yeah.
They have advanced machinery controlling it. And yet at the same time, what happens when you boil off alcohol is there is what they call the head, the heart, and the tail. The head is what comes off first, the stuff that boils at a lower temperature.
Right.
And that often has weird flavors and aromas. So you want to discard that. Then you get to the core of it, the heart, which is generally 70 or 80% of the volume of what you're boiling. And that's the delicious stuff. But then after that's gone, you get the tail, which again is sort of weird, garlicky or hay-smelling liquid. So there's the science, which is the computer controlling, and then there's the art, which is being able to tell, being able to smell the exact moment
right.
when you've gotten rid of all the bad stuff and are in the good stuff.
So can we get this quality here?
There's two of the absolute best schnapps makers, Reisetbauer and Gulles, G-O-L-L-E-S,
right.
are both distributed in the U.S. They're a bit hard to find. You have to go to a pretty good quality liquor store to find them. Those are definitely ones to look for, especially Reisetbauer. He is more widely distributed and really is pretty much recognized as the greatest schnapps maker in Austria. So we're very lucky to be able to get his stuff. There are a couple of American makers of schnapps. Clear Creek up in Oregon makes some pretty good stuff. It's not on the level of the Austrian stuff.
Uh-huh.
Sorry, guys, but it's good. It's
right.
It's good and it's American-made and therefore a bit easier to get.
Well, Matt, thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I love talking about this stuff. I'm really thirsty now, too.
Thanks, Matt. You take care.
Thank you.
Matt Gross writes the Getting Lost column for the New York Times travel section. His schnapps suggestions can be found on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, now, what does one eat with schnapps? Well, the fruit schnapps match is logical. For instance, pear schnapps with maybe pears poached in honey. Then there's the contrast approach. For instance, raspberry schnapps with thin, thin, really intensely dark chocolate cookies. And don't overlook the savory side. Peach schnapps with old cheddar, I mean good old cheddar, and toasted almonds. Michael Stern are bliss followers of the First Order. Their job is to find prime local eats and then report in on them to their website, Road Food, and to us here. So, Jane, Michael, what's the big reveal this week?
The big reveal is we have been in Rochester, New York, eating a garbage plate.
Oh, come on.
Now, I know. This sounds like, the ultimate stirred food, junk food taken to the nth degree. But the garbage plate, as originated at Nick Tahu's restaurant in Rochester, has become such a popular thing there, and the name is trademarked by Nick Tahu, that other places have opened up around Rochester serving dumpster plates, trash plates, messy plates, sloppy plates, and rubbish plates.
And even one place that serves a plat de refuse.
Oh, I love it. Okay, but you have to tell me what
is it?
What is the blessed thing?
Okay, first of all, it begins with one of those super heavy-duty cardboard plates, you know, the kind of indestructible ones.
Right.
And on top of that, you put like you definitely put some potato salad, some beans, and some macaroni salad. Mm-hmm. On top of those three salads, which completely cover the plate, you get a brace of hot dogs or hamburgers or cheeseburgers or maybe Italian sausage, steak, or fried eggs.
You're
any
saying
one of
plurals
those.
All here. These are plurals.
Yes, all plurals.
Hamburgers. Yes.
Now, okay. That's your protein layer.
I understand.
On top of that, you want some hot sauce, some cheese, and what else? What am I forgetting?
Well, it's not just hot sauce. It's like a chili. It's a meaty chili sauce.
It's like a meaty chili sauce, yes.
And then onions.
Onions and melted cheese.
And then a little piece of bread on the top.
Because you don't have enough carbohydrates.
No, bread and butter, excuse me.
Oh,
bread
excuse me.
They
don't
always
have
serve
fat.
The bread with pats of butter.
And God forbid a green leaf should enter this thing, right?
No. We're talking about, the home of the garbage plate doesn't know about green leaves. Actually, one of the most interesting garbage plates was discovered by our friends Bruce and Sue the last time we were there. They were there with us. And they ordered a grilled cheese sandwich garbage plate, which instead of the hot dogs or hamburgers, two grilled cheese sandwiches were actually set upon the starch layer.
I'm always waiting for some snobby food critic, not us, obviously, to go in and stand up and say, this is garbage. And the cook to say, yeah.
And your point is.
But where, first of all, how does it taste?
Like a lot of ingredients.
It's actually, it's one of those things where no single element on a garbage plate is delicious in and of itself, but combine them all, and it's one of those kind of transcendent chords of cuisine. You know, it's not a note, it's a chord.
You know, this really appeals to me because you've never seen me at a buffet, but if you
yes,
are,
Jane makes her own garbage plates right. At every buffet we go to.
I can't not, I just can't resist not taking a bite of everything. And just, you know, the plate is 12 inches across. And by the time I reach the end of the buffet, I have about 16 strata. You know, it looks like an archaeological dig of cheeses and breads.
Oh,
and
I
meats.
Understand this.
You understand.
You know, I'm the person when no one's looking that mixes the cranberry sauce, the turkey gravy, the leftover peas
yes!
into my mashed potatoes,
yes,
and I throw
yes,
in,
yes,
yeah,
yes,
you know.
Too.
But how did this start here?
Well, it actually started during the Depression as a dish called Hots and Patats, Hots being the upstate New York name for hot dogs. And Nick Tahu created it as a way to, like, get maximum calories for minimum dollars. And, you know, it's still – the restaurant still has that feel about it. I mean, it's a very kind of the city kind of place. Mm-hmm. Everyone is welcome. It's open not exactly 24 hours, but almost 24 hours.
Not fancy.
And Alex Tahu, Nick's son, who still runs it, you know, he feeds needy kids at Christmas. He's always got some charity he's doing. He's one of those, like – you know, one of those people in a city who just is always doing everything mm-hmm. for everybody. And yeah. I think serving the garbage plate sort of fits into that because it's a way that anyone can get like a 12,000-calorie meal for a few dollars.
And I think also Rochester had an image problem because Buffalo, with their Buffalo chicken wings, had kind of taken over upstate New York cuisine. And so the garbage plate became like a contender for the crown.
Well, if you're going to have a crown, why not have it be a garbage plate? Okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
Guys, thank you.
Bye, Lynn.
Yeah, you know my baby. She run off with the garbage man. Yeah, you know my sweet little baby. She run off with the garbage man. Yeah, you know I need this good-looking woman so she can empty my canes.
Jane and Michael Stern are the minds behind RoadFood.com.
That garbage plate is a bit of a culinary challenge. I can't match it, but in the spirit of go-for-it one-plate meals, I offer 21st-century mac and cheese. And if you want to heap on a Texas wiener, do it. The recipe's on our website, splendidtable.org. We're coming back in a moment with the question, are we humans hardwired to be meat eaters or not? I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This podcast is brought to you by EasyCanvasPrints.com. Take your favorite family photos, pictures of the kids, or those amazing vacation photos, and have them printed on gallery canvas like you might see in a museum. Starting at $19.99, you can have a beautiful gallery canvas print for your home or office. Visit EasyCanvasPrints.com/splendidtable to receive 50% off your canvas print. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You know, you watch Mad Men and you are reminded that once upon a time, a big steak on your plate meant that you had arrived. Right now, that steak may raise eyebrows. We humans have a puzzling relationship with meat. I mean, that is, should we eat it at all? And if so, why do we eat certain meats and not others? Well, psychology professor Hal Herzog is intrigued by this puzzle, and he's studied it at length. His research has been published in numerous academic journals, and now he joins us with his book, Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat, Why It's So Hard to Think Straight About Animals. Hal Herzog, welcome.
Well, thanks for having me, Lynn.
So you know the first question, right? Why is it so hard for us to think straight about animals?
Well, one of the things that I learned in writing this book actually changed some of my ideas about human nature. And I have come to appreciate the role of culture in human behavior to a degree that I never did before. And I think a lot of the foods that we eat really are defined by culture. And so in some cultures, for example, dog eating is accepted. Mm-hmm. In other cases, it's not. But interestingly enough, the reasons why dogs are not eaten in cultures really vary. So, for example, in Islamic cultures, dogs are not eaten in part is because they see dogs the way we see rats. They're seen as being disgusting and they're seen as being vermin. On the other hand, we don't eat dogs because we love them. So even the animals we taboo are often tabooed in different cultures for different reasons.
This is obvious, but we're so human, aren't we? I mean, there's no logic here, is there?
That you have absolutely captured the reason I wrote this book. That's what I really wanted people to struggle with. I really wanted people to struggle with the fact that we are human. And so at every level, our decisions, including the decisions on what it's good to eat and what it's not good to eat, are this bizarre combination of logic and rationality and then gut level and emotion. And that is a theme that just runs through so much of human behavior. And it really transcends food.
So along those lines, are human beings wired to crave meat and to eat meat? Or is it a choice we can make?
I think the answer to that is both. And I think that there's overwhelming...
That's not helpful, Hal.
It might not be helpful, but it's true. And I know people like simple answers to complicated questions, but in this case, there's not a simple answer. I am convinced that we are wired, at least most of us are wired, to find the taste of flesh not just tasty, but almost irresistible. But that's not true of everyone. For example, I have two daughters. I have daughters that are twins. Uh-huh. And so they were raised in the same food environment. However, one of them has been a vegetarian for 15 years, and the other one is a confirmed meat eater. And I'm convinced that partially that's because of even that they're not identical twins, they're fraternal twins, is that one just doesn't like the taste of meat. But most people do. In fact, one of the surprising things I learned in writing the book is the fact that most self-described vegetarians actually eat meat. Large-scale studies conducted by the Department of Agriculture show that when you call people that describe themselves vegetarians on the phone, and you say, tell me what you've eaten in the last 24 hours, that two-thirds of vegetarians have actually eaten some form of animal flesh, not within the last month or the last year, mm-hmm. but in the previous day. And so the actual number of vegetarians in the United States is surprisingly small, despite what you hear from the media. And the fact is that study after study shows that between 97 and 99% of Americans eat meat. So, you know, you ask about that nature nurture thing. One of the reasons why I think that humans are, in fact, hardwired, although it doesn't make it inevitable, hardwired for eating meat, is the fact that even most vegetarians can't give it up.
But I'm thinking, too, I mean, so much of the decisions people are making now about not eating meat have to do with ecology, have to do with how much fossil fuel goes into producing that meat. So the turning away from meat is not solely about cravings, but about what one believes is important.
That's absolutely true. And what we find, there's a psychologist at the University of Pennsylvania, Paul Rosin, who's actually done studies of people that give up meat for moral versus health reasons. And it turns out that moral vegetarians are more likely, number one, to find meat disgusting. They're more inclined to have a well-developed set of reasons mm-hmm. for not eating meat. And they actually perceive meat eaters more negatively than do health vegetarians.
Interesting.
There's also this idea that's really very common across human cultures, that you literally are what you eat. People that, you know, if you see other people as meat eaters, you're more likely to see them as being aggressive. Interestingly enough, there's some pretty good information on that, pretty good data on that.
Uh-huh. So what's your personal opinion, Hal, about vegetarians versus meat eaters?
I think that vegetarians are sort of moral models for us all, even though I think that eating meat is a natural human tendency. Like a lot of human tendencies that aren't necessarily good, that vegetarians show us a way and that it's possible to overcome some of our natural human tendencies. Some people are more successful than others. Some of them are completely successful, some of them not so much, but at least they're giving it a try.
Very interesting. Hal, thank you.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Psychology professor Hal Herzog's book is Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat, Why It's So Hard to Think Straight About Animals. Well, to take the discussion to the table, here's a dish from India. Now, there, the Hindu population begs the question, are all of us wired to eat meat? I mean, the Hindus there have not eaten meat for about 3,000 years, and the food is delicious. An example of it is Raghavan Iyer's grilled flatbread with chili-spiked onions. And it's on the website, splendidtable.org. Fine art of the stash, a.k.a. planning for leftovers. I mean, you want to be PC, you could say this is the truly sustainable way to eat. And it sounds much more elegant in French, le reste. And that's how British food writer Diana Henry refers to them. Well, if you sneer at leftovers, listen up. This could rock your world. Diana Henry, welcome.
It's great to be with you again.
Let's talk about sustainability at its most basic, as in planning for leftovers.
Well, you must approach leftovers with an even kind of greedier palate and more enthusiasm than if you're kind of sitting down to plan the most wonderful dinner party. And I think it's quite easy, actually. The cooking I love to do is not the sort of cooking that is show-off cooking that you've shopped for a week for. It will be. You look in the fridge and you think, oh, look, there's that and there's that and there's that. What can I do with them? I find restriction kind of inspiring in a way. I think sometimes when you have complete freedom, you can have whatever you want, you can afford whatever you want. You don't come up with something as good. So I think it's great to kind of think of what's in the fridge and then put something together.
Okay, but let's do an example.
The chicken. I know these days that's the kind of Sunday roast of choice in Britain. I don't think people have beef very often at all. And lamb, not so often either. But chicken, the Sunday roast chicken is a big thing here. And I have always liked the idea of kind of what we do with it then on a Monday. And I must say, I'm very good because I come from a farming background and my mum is also a very good cook. I can really strip a chicken carcass like nobody else. If you've got people will look at a chicken carcass and say, there's hardly anything on that. I say, oh, yes, there is. There's another kind of like couple of meals on that. And a lot of people, I think, actually don't like doing that so much these days if they're not into food. They're kind of like the handling of meat is a funny thing for some people. But that's what you have to do. And then quite often, honestly, I was just on the underground on the way here to come and talk to you. And I started making a list of all the things I can do with chicken on a Monday night. And I didn't know where to stop. And mostly, I'd say I like them better than the things I quite often have with it in the first place, you know, the plain Sunday roast. I think also with leftovers, you have to think kind of big flavours. You have to think very definite kind of dishes. So I cook quite a lot of Middle Eastern stuff. That's one thing. So you've got pilafs that you can cook with just rice and the chicken tossed with that at the end so that it's warmed through. But you've got pistachios. You can have dates. You can have little chopped up apricots, preserved lemons, all that kind of, and then lots of herbs. Things with big, big flavour. And Eastern food is brilliant as well, like Vietnamese stuff, which is also very, very healthy. I think sometimes we think of leftovers as being unhealthy because, you know, we stick them in pies or we put them into a gratin with a bechamel. But there are loads of healthy things that you can do with them as well.
Well, you know, forgetting health for a moment, though, let's go back to that pie. And, you know, in the United States, we don't do a lot of savory pies.
Really?
Yeah, no, we really don't. I mean, our pies tend to be sweet pies. So what, yeah, with that roast chicken leftover, okay, I've already served up most of it on Sunday, and it's Monday night,
yep,
a pie.
That's easy, and that's not expensive cooking at all. You could do, and I'm a great one for kind of fiddling about with other people's cuisine, so I do a Greek-inspired chicken and roast pumpkin and spinach pie with,
wow,
a layer of ricotta mixed with crumbled feta and eggs and a bit of parmesan. And you get phyllo pastry, which of course you buy, and you layer that up, buttering as you go. In a springform cake tin is good,
right,
or if you have another kind of baking dish. So you put in some layers of phyllo, layer those other ingredients up there, seasoning well as you go, pull all the little flaps of pastry over the top, put some more on that, butter it and into the oven. And that's delicious, and you haven't even had to make a pastry. But I'm a big fan of kind of very old-fashioned pies. Like, I would make an old-fashioned bechamel sauce and put into it leeks that I'd sautéed for a long time so they're really soft.
Mm.
Maybe some ham that's cooked, and I've got that from the deli counter at the supermarket, and then my leftover chicken. And on top of the pie dish, I put a layer of puff pastry on, brush it with egg, put that in the oven, and that's ready very quickly as well. And that's delicious. And we do love them, and men love them. Oh, my God, British men love pies.
You are outrageous, woman. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Diana Henry's latest book is Plenty, Good Uncomplicated Food for the Sustainable Kitchen. And one of her leftover chicken recipes is chicken and ham pie. You can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. Time to turn to your calls. Pick up the phone, 800-537-5252. Go to Facebook, tweet, or send an email, splendidtable.org. Jack is calling from Beaufort, North Carolina. Jack, you live in one of the prettiest towns I've ever had the privilege to spend time in.
It certainly is.
What do you want to talk about?
Well, I have a question about wines from the 18th century. I recently acquired five antique Flint glass wine glasses that were advertised to be from the late 1700s to early 1800s.
Yeah.
I'm an artist, and I bought them to use as subjects for some still life paintings that I was planning to do.
Yeah.
What really attracted me to them, aside from their beauty, was the fact that they were identical to many of the wine glasses which were used by one of my favorite artists, the 18th century American painter Raphael Peale, in a lot of his still life paintings.
Right, right.
Also, this particular lot of five glasses were each slightly different in design, which meant that I could use each glass in a different painting without mm-hmm. being redundant. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow, I can get my money's worth out of these.
Right, right.
So anyway, I get the glasses unpacked after receiving them and line them up on a table to take a look at them all. And I guess because each glass was just a little bit different, I began to imagine that each glass had a different wine in it.
Uh-huh.
And then this instantly led me to imagine the whole scene as sort of a colonial period wine tasting with little, like, folded cards in front of each glass describing the type of wine in each. And then, of course, the cards would be handwritten with a feather quill. And I don't even know if they had wine tastings, per se, back in the colonial period.
If they didn't, they should have.
Yeah, and that's what I thought. And the whole idea really seemed very exciting, you know, to explore in a still life painting.
So you want to know, am I anticipating that you want to have an idea of what kind of wines might have been in those glasses?
Yeah, I came to a screeching halt after that.
I have to first say this as a qual. I am holding back because I am a collector when I have the money of
yeah.
that period. And I have, a little information is a dangerous thing. One of the reasons all those glasses are different is that they're handmade. The other thing is glasses were really expensive and generally only the wealthy had them in it. Wouldn't have been unusual to have one glass at a per place per person, and they would have that. They would rinse the glasses in water between wines if they were having an elaborate meal.
Mm-hmm.
And people collect wine rinsers, which are these sort of bowls that have lips on either end, so you can the wine you've seen the wine glasses are really small. They almost sometimes look like cordial glasses.
Exactly.
Right.
I was surprised when I received them that they were so small.
Well, okay. I'm not an expert in 18th century wines, but there are a few things I remember. Number one, things were often doctored to help them last longer. So they might have sugar added to them. They might have nefarious things added. But things like the equivalent of port, Madeira,
right. would
have been served. There may have been local wines like, elderberry or wines that would have been made in your area. That would have been in colonial America, definitely would have been made. And living where you live, I'll bet you have access to a lot of fruit wines.
The muscadines, scuppernongs.
Exactly. Those kinds of things would have been drunk by your ancestors there. First of all, there's some interesting material that you can find if you check Colonial Williamsburg, their site, mm-hmm. because they have a lot of material. And you can also look at Deerfield. Which is Deerfield is a restored village in Massachusetts, and they have
right.
publications. And then the American Heritage Society might have some publications because there are historians who specialize in this. And you may run across a word called Malaga, and this is sort of an offshoot of Madeira, a very early version. And it was made in Malaga in the Mediterranean. And this is almost tastes like you've put raisins or prunes in a bottle of port. It's very rich. So you're going to find wines that almost taste like cordials or things you might today drink after dinner or before. And then you're going to find wines that are local, made from fruits. You're going to have a big selection. You're going to have to order more glasses.
No. Well, I'm like you in the money department. Sometimes
it
ebbs and flows.
Hey, thanks for a great question. Now I'm off and running.
Well, Lynn, thanks so much for the insight and for these links that I can go to find the information.
Well, just keep us posted what you end
up
doing. We'd love to know.
When I finish the painting, I'll send you an image.
I would love that, Jack. That would be great.
Well, thanks again, Lynn, and I love your show.
Well, thank you, sir. Thank you. Thanks for calling.
Bye. Right,
bye-bye. Oh, you got to know. I have to tell you, collecting for the table, it can be plastic-handled forks from the 70s. Anyway, point being, it really gets you in trouble because you'll never stop. Anyway, Call us, 800-537-5252.
It is time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what new and some would think creepy help you shop technology is coming to your supermarket? Well, we're coming back with that answer and more conversation with you. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. We'll be talking to you in a minute, so get in touch. You can follow us on Twitter or Facebook. Pick up the phone. That's 800-537-5252. Send us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what new and some may think creepy help you shop technology is coming to your supermarket? Well, Kraft Foods is scoping out our faces while we shop. Soon, a store near you may have a screen in a kiosk. You give the screen a glance, and it instantly knows your gender, your age group. And then new technology figures out what will lure you into buying Kraft products for supper. If you look like a couch potato, there's Cheese Whiz, Ritz crackers, and Bullseye Barbecue. The screen downloads recipes and a shopping list into your phone. So helpful, and indeed, totally creepy. Okay, let's get back to your questions. You can reach us at 800-537-5252 or check us out on Facebook. Anita's on the line from Nashville. Anita, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hey, I am going to a spice shower for my daughter who's getting married, and each guest has been assigned to bring a spice. So I am bringing smoked paprika.
Ooh, that could be so good.
I didn't even know such a thing existed, but I'm really excited, and I thought, what a fun thing to get your ideas about smoked paprika.
Well, it's from Spain, right?
Okay.
Yeah, and it is it the hot kind or the mild kind?
I haven't purchased it yet. I just need to bring it and a recipe.
All right. I would say get the sweet kind.
Okay.
You know, the mild kind, because you can always add a little hot heat if you need to.
Mm-hmm.
There is a sauce that's used in Spain, which is where the smoked paprikas originated.
Okay.
That you can use as a dip for vegetables. You can spread it on toast, and you can use it over almost anything, any main dish.
Mm.
And it's called romesco. And this is kind of what I remember, all right?
Okay.
I'm going to give you the basics.
Sure. Good.
Okay. You want to gather together roasted sweet peppers, red ones,
mm-hmm.
some tomatoes. You want a really crunchy, chewy bread like ciabatta, you know?
Okay.
Yeah. You want olive oil. You want almonds, all right?
Okay.
And you want garlic and you want onion. And then that paprika. And salt
Gosh,
and pepper.
What's not to like?
Exactly. I mean, come on. It's got to be good. Okay. So you're going to toast the almonds. Ideally, there should be whole almonds, and they can have skin on if they do. You know, it's
okay.
fine. But you want to toast them, get them really nutty. And then what you're going to do, you're going to take maybe a 10-inch skillet,
mm-hmm.
all right, and you're going to film the bottom of it generously with olive oil. And you're going to take about a teaspoon of the paprika. Have
okay.
that ready, a heaping teaspoon.
Okay.
And you're going to thin slice an onion, like a medium onion.
Okay.
And you're going to add that to this warm oil, all right?
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to have a couple of cloves of garlic that you're going to thin slice too. And you're going to warm them in the oil. You're not really cooking them. You're just starting to cook them.
Okay.
And then you're going to sprinkle them with salt and pepper and that paprika.
And
you're warming the paprika. You're mm-hmm. just getting it so you really get its aroma. And then you take that out of the pan, you put it into a food processor. All right?
Okay.
Now you film the pan again with a bit of olive oil. You tear apart that ciabatta bread, which is best if it's a couple of days old.
Mm-hmm.
And you crisp it in that oil, like you're making a crouton.
Oh, great.
Okay? And that goes into the food processor.
Mm.
And then you put in two or three or four roasted sweet red peppers.
Okay.
You put in a
good-sized handful of the toasted almonds.
Mm.
All right?
Mm-hmm.
And you cut up maybe two medium, really good-tasting tomatoes, or you use four or five good canned tomatoes.
Okay.
And you puree that all together.
Okay.
And then you taste it, you adjust the seasoning, and you finish with lemon juice to taste.
Well, my daughter is a big, kind of spontaneous, freewheeling girl. So
oh, this is great.
This is perfect for
this
her.
Is great.
Thank you so
much. You are
much.
Welcome. And
love
and
it.
And congratulations to your daughter.
Okay, for sure. Thanks, Lynn.
Take care.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye. You can call us 800-537-5252 or go online, splendidtable.org, or check us out on Facebook. Scott is calling from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Scott, what do you want to talk about?
Well, Lynn, thank you so much for taking my phone call. I'm a food service director at a local university here in Grand Rapids.
Right.
And at best, I'm a cook, definitely not a chef by far. And I'm interested in starting to learning how to bake breads at home. So I'm looking for a cookbook that'll give me the basics, maybe some tips and what tools I need to do the job and some of the science behind it as well. Do you have any recommendations?
Oh, I have a couple of them. How deep do you wish to go into the science and the detail behind? No, because there's one book. There's a bread-making method. It's been called five-minute bread. It's been called no-bake bread. Now, there's actually a book out. It's
wonderful.
It's called Artisan Bread in 5 Minutes a Day.
Okay.
It's by two people, Zoe Francois and Jeff Hertzberg. And then there is a book written by the man who first created this technique. And by the way, this is not going to taste like shortcut bread.
Mm-hmm.
This is going to taste like fabulous artisan-made bread. It's fascinating, the process. Okay, but the man who created the technique is a man named Jim Leahy, L-A-H-E-Y. He's a baker in New York, and he wrote a book called simply My Bread. Now, this is a deep immersion into how a baker works and the science and whatever. And there's a fair amount of reading to do, but the recipe is the simplest going. But I would try artisan bread in 5 minutes a day first.
Okay.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's going to get you into making a lot of different kinds of breads. And the system is really interesting. It goes back to the way European breads have been made forever, which is you essentially add a little bit of yeast to flour and water and a lot more liquid than you normally think, and you let it sit overnight. Or about 18 hours, and it ferments and it develops great flavor, and then you start to actually, you know, do work with it with the bread, but you don't have to knead, and it will open up a world to you.
Oh, sounds wonderful.
Okay.
And it sounds like something my little girl can do with me too.
Your little girl? Oh, yes. Go forth and bake, Scott.
I will. Thank you very much.
You are welcome.
Bye.
Bye. Reach us. Send us an email, splendidtable.org, or call 800-537-5252. We've got Kim calling from Salida, Colorado. Kim, hi. What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I am just wanting to talk about Indian food. My husband and I love Indian food, and I was really excited to hear your interview with Raghavan Iyer with his 660 curries.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
and
yeah.
I bought the book for my husband and myself for Christmas, and we've been looking through it, and we're kind of like not sure what to do with it because we live in this small mountain town that does not have an Indian market or even, you know, a big Whole Foods type store.
Right, so right, right. So it's hard to find some of the ingredients.
Yeah, we have cumin and coriander and turmeric and stuff like that, but there's some really funky ingredients in here and some things that I'd love to make. And so what I'd like to know from you is what do you think are some key seasonings that I should get that I could mail order or, you know, go to the city and get?
I think if you're in Denver, which would be where you'd be shopping,
mm-hmm.
right, and no doubt there's Asian stores, and if there isn't a specific, you know, if there aren't specific groceries that carry solely Indian goods, Asian stores, because I know you've got a huge Asian community in Denver, a very significant one, and the shopping is dynamite. These are some of the things I think I would get. First of all, I'd get tamarind concentrate. I would get whole spices, which you can get in your local supermarket, because just grinding those whole spices or doing what the recipes tell you in terms of either toasting them or frying them brings you fabulous Indian flavor. I would get, if I could, some of the dried beans and lentils, you know, the dal, because there are many different forms of that. And I would look at the recipes and see, what does he use most frequently? There might be three or four legumes that you see used again and again. Like chana dal is used a great deal in many, many Indian, you know, dishes. So you'd be safe with chana dal.
Okay.
Also, look up the definitions, because some of the things that have an Indian name are things like yellow split peas.
Mm-hmm.
Or green split peas.
Right.
Or a lentil, like it may be a red lentil, which maybe you can get. But
Yeah, I can.
The other thing I would stock up on is some of the bottled chutneys. The things like, for instance, there's a tomato chutney or sauce that is done that is really delicious, which you can get in a jar. That can be mint and chilies, and I think there is some coconut milk or something like that in it. So these are some of the basics. Look through and see what he repeats constantly. Like, is there dried mango powder? Is there, are there spice blends that he suggests?
Mm-hmm.
Because the other thing you can find are these spice blends, and they come in little boxes. They're about $1 a piece.
Right.
Always check the dates on them and read the ingredients. But generally, when you read the ingredients, they're pretty pure.
Well, I was so proud of myself. I found garam masala in our town, in our health food store. And then I read the book, and apparently there are about 100 different kinds of garam masala.
That's okay. That's okay.
and
he and many other Indian cooks will offer you recipes, and that's something you can generally make yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But when you see fenugreek used a lot, for instance, that's hard to find. So that's what you would find in an Asian store.
Yeah.
You see, or you'd mail order it.
Right.
Okay, and I think he's got mail order sources at the back of the book.
Oh, I haven't gotten to the very back.
Oh,
so
go to the back of the
book. I'll look back there.
There's a whole ingredient section somewhere in the book. And also check, because there's a lot of things in that book that don't need a lot of special stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And frozen mango, by the way. I know I keep throwing these things out, but frozen mango will never let you down.
Okay.
I love frozen mangoes.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you.
You enjoy this. This is a great area to explore. It really is.
I love it.
Okay.
Thanks a lot, Lynn.
You're welcome. Bye, Kim. You can call us at 800-537-5252. Check us out on Facebook, tweet, or send us an email, splendidtable.org. In this day of apps and GPSs, I don't mean to be a Luddite, but when you're traveling, nothing beats holding a map in your hands, especially when the map has food as its focus. Ken Sheps has created Mapitite. Ken, welcome.
Thank you, Lynn.
Well, first of all, are you a map lover?
I love maps. My mom was a collector of maps for years and years, and I kind of inherited the interest from her.
So describe what Mapitite is, or what this map is.
Mapitite is a pretty much complete city guide, and we went about it. I have a business partner. Her name is Robin, and we decided to build a better map. And this map flips and folds, so it's basically a series of panels. And you can expand it out like a traditional map, but the key is that you can flip and fold and keep it focused in on neighborhoods. So you go right into a neighborhood, and it's the must-visit neighborhoods, the must-see landmarks, and most importantly, we layered in the great places to eat and to shop for food in those neighborhoods.
I have the London map here. And just to describe it, this opens up just the way a normal map does.
Right.
But then there are, for each fold, okay, you can just open up that one fold, and then there's like a flip over. It lists everything that's there. And you've coded it by color, so everything that's orange is something to see, like a museum. And everything that's highlighted in yellow is to do with food, and everything is numbered, so I can find 12 is called the Westbourne, and it's evidently a culinary pub, and I can just flip back over, and there's the map of that neighborhood, and I can find number 12, and there's the culinary pub. It's a really clever idea. Now, do you check out every single one of the food places you talk about?
Yes, we go back and back to each of the restaurants, food shops, bakeries. And, you know, what we're looking for is a great cook, a great chef, a great baker, a great grocer, someone who takes so much mm-hmm. pride in what they do, and then you experience it. Because that's one of the great things about visiting a city is tasting it. That's how you really experience it.
Yeah, yeah.
And do you highlight the choicest neighborhoods? I mean, the ones where in a relatively short period of time you can cover an awful lot of great stuff?
Right. We definitely focus in on the must-visit neighborhoods. And we also do what we call the Mappetite Mile, and we focus in on that on our website, mappetite.com. When you're in, like you mentioned, the Westbourne,
This is in London. That's the restaurant.
Right, in London. Yep. And that's in Notting Hill. And you can take Portobello Road, and you could just take it to the end, and you'll find a great, there's like Garcia's Fine Foods of Spain, and it's just a wonderful shop. And then the road kind of fizzles out. But if you walk about 5 minutes further, 5-10 minutes further, you are at Goulbourne Road. And this was once a thriving Portuguese community. And there is a couple of bakeries that are just to die for. And that's what we try to include. We include the must-visit neighborhoods. And when there's in the peripheral, on the border, is there something that we can get you to? Mm-hmm. And you'll take that memory with you. You know, it's just something special.
It's the kind of thing you're always looking for. Ken, we wish you great luck with it. And
Thanks so much.
Thanks for talking with us.
It's been great, Lynn. Thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Ken Sheps has created Mappetite Maps. Now, he's got an inherited sixth sense about bakeries. He told me that his grandfather was a legendary Bialy baker in New York City. Now, for those of you who have never met up with a Bialy, this is an art form. The Bialy is a bagel without a hole, and it's covered with fried onions. Insanely delicious for breakfast. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for being with us. And remember, you can reach us anytime. Just send us an email, splendidtable.org. Call us, 800-537-5252. And until next time, let me leave you with this Zen blessing at mealtime. In this plate of food, I see the entire universe supporting my existence. Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media. Take a look at splendidtable.org for additional information on anything you heard here today. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson and Mary Beth Leone Gettin. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Chris Holacek. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.